next speaker is Janet Warren on mental illness, evaluating medical, physical, and psychological approaches.
Good afternoon. So, what is a human? To be human is to think and live and feel in a messy world. So consequently, psychological problems or mental illness is common. I'm going to focus on contemporary conceptions on mental illness, and I'll give you my background is it comes from my experience practicing psychotherapy. I'm primarily doing trauma recovery work, listening to stories. And as a theologian, I'm very much a proponent of integration. Okay, I have to hit it three times. So this is the part that I'm going to skip because I'm sure that everybody is aware of our contemporary mental health crisis. 1 in 5 chance of having something in a lifetime, high incidence in marginalized populations. According to the World Health Organization, depression is the third leading cause of disease burden worldwide. There's been an increase, about 13% incidence in the past decade. Nobody knows why. It could be an awareness factor, so likely sociocultural reasons. Historically, up until the past century or so, mental illness was sort of considered as moral failure. Somebody was bad. People were institutionalized. There was, in ancient world, people who had any sort of psychological problems were considered that they were demonized. You know, the horror stories and people were mostly women, were burned as witches for having any sort of mental problems. Overall, people with mental problems in the past had early deaths. There are some interesting exceptions. We've heard the stories of artists like Van Gogh, who probably had some mental illness, but yet produced amazing work. Martin Luther is another example of somebody who probably had some sort of mental illness. Labels that in the past, terms that we've used, things like madness, always negative implications, always some sort of form of a stigma, a sense of shame, disgrace, etc. So in the past century, there have been a lot of positive changes, particularly with the development of medications. So any sort of psychological problems have become more scientific, more clinicalized, etc. We've come up with diagnostic criteria, and we've come up with multiple different types of psychotherapy. As I mentioned, a lot of increased awareness, education. So less stigma. And mostly that's a very good thing. There's been improved outcomes, a lot more freedom. But I do question if perhaps the pendulum has swung too far and we need to reevaluate it. In terms of Christian assumptions, Christians have often uncritically followed the views of the prevailing culture. So in the past, Christians were against it and say, well, you just pray or it's a demon or something. But certainly in the last few decades, Christians have said, oh, it's a mental illness, go see your doctor, and sort of divorced this. They have in the past, again, historically, there were some wonderful Christians who pioneered reforms in some of the institutions, for example, advocated compassionate treatment. But those views often lagged behind. And in the past, too, there was an emphasis on sin as a causative factor in any sort of mental illness. But currently, the medical model of mental illness is widely accepted. However, the issue is complex. Somebody asked me for a summary of my talk at lunch, and I said, it's complex. you can all leave now. So despite what you hear on the media and all these terms and everything that sounds so scientific, it's actually not as scientific as we like to think. So there's a wide spectrum of conditions, and I one of my critiques is that lumping things together. Somebody with schizophrenia is very different from a kid with some ADD tendencies, for example. Definitions are imprecise. It's very interesting to look at the history of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, because some things that used to be diseases are no longer diseases. Homosexuality is a prime example of that. And some things that were not diseases are now considered diseases. influence of our language and our culture. You know, there's a joke about depression is normal in Britain because, you know, everybody's sad. So there's cultural influences, there's different ways of understanding things, different models, perspective. It can be viewed through the lens of philosophy as anthropology and sociology. All these things can inform our conceptions. I, like with many things, I would suggest that multiple models are often helpful. And of course, I like to view things through the lens of Christian theology. But let's just look now at the medical model. So it tends to view, so it includes a wide spectrum of conditions and tends to view mental illness as a physical disease with biological or organic causes. Tends to focus on genetics, neurotransmission, neuroimaging is the new thing, and medication is often used as treatment. So there are some strengths to it, for sure. It's viewed as objective, being based on science. And as we know, science is wonderful. It's given some insight into the causes of some conditions and certainly some insight into treatment of conditions. Treatment can be quick and can be relatively cheap. It's kept people out of institutions. It can be effective in controlling some serious conditions like schizophrenia. And this sort of seeing mental illness as a sickness has definitely reduced the stigma and reduced some of the fear in those who've had mental problems. However, there are some weaknesses as well. So from the scientific point of view, the medical model tends to ignore social, psychological, environmental factors. Diagnoses tend to focus on clusters of symptoms rather than on root causes. So trauma, for example, you put kids in the same sort of condition and people might end up with about six different mental illnesses from the same root cause. There's a minimization of the huge diversity, even with one condition between people and then between different types of conditions. Problem of definitions. They're done often by consensus and they change over the years, which just shows what science does change in general, but mental problems change more than others. There's often, although to be fair, the term illness as opposed to disease is a little bit better because illness at least implies that there's a subjective component to it. So that is one good thing, at least calling it mental illness as opposed to mental disease. Interestingly, the reliability of diagnosing mental disorders has not improved in 30 years. And this is huge. There's been a failure to find convincing physical causes for most mental illness. There's no biological tests. There's no brain scans. There's lots of theories. There's some correlations that have been found. But it's basically now known as the myth of the chemical imbalance. A lot of people go around, oh, I have a chemical imbalance. Nothing has ever been proven. And actually, there was just a recent meta-analysis finding no relationship between serotonin levels and depression. So 40 years or more of testing, thousands of studies, no direct evidence. Treatments can have serious side effects, even minor. Some people on medication say they don't feel like themselves. The drugs may simply act as like a chemical straitjacket. Drugs are often sort of a life sentence for people. The drugs sometimes work better for they work better for the healthcare provider than they do for the patient, or they work better for the relatives than they do for the patient. It ignores the importance of language, ignores the importance of meaning, of social engagement. So actually from a social perspective, other critiques include ethical issues of labeling somebody as mentally ill. Labeling can lead to some discrimination, loss of rights. It can also lead to a problem of malingering. Like, oh, I can be off work because I have an illness. And I'm not, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that everybody does this. I'm saying that these are potential issues with a medical model. As I mentioned, there's subjective cultural influences on these diagnoses. There's no value-free model. The diagnostic manuals that are so often cited are not works of objective science, but works of culture, because they've been developed through clinical consensus and voting. And I mentioned homosexuality. Alcoholism is now considered a disease where it was not before. Another concern is that it can pathologize normal variations. So a lot of people argue that autism spectrum disorder, for example, which also has had a whole lot of different names in the last few years, is not a disease, but is a normal variation. Normal emotions. So often people go through grief, and because our society doesn't know how to deal with it, you have a grief disorder, have a pill. The medical model can lead to overdiagnosis, and misdiagnosis can lead to unrealistic expectations about happiness. Like, nobody has to be depressed anymore. We can all be happy. It idolizes sort of this conception of what's normal. There can be false dichotomies that develop, or these are the mentally well and these are the mentally ill. They can become sort of an us-them type mentality. Some illnesses actually can have a positive dimension. And I mentioned some great artists who've suffered. A common one is ADD, where often the people who have it, or whatever the term would be, symptoms that fall under that cluster, whatever, they actually enjoy their creativity, but it's their family members that want them treated sometimes. Another big concern is there's a potential for loss of personal responsibility for behavior, and it can promote passivity. It's like, I have an illness, don't have to do anything. It can discourage any sense of autonomy and control. So now it's no longer the devil made me do it, but it's the disease made me do it. And we see this like in the legal system, for example. Also has psychospiritual implications, can preclude people getting the healing that they need. So like I said, overall, it's not completely bad. There's some, it has helped, but it should not be uncritically accepted. So what about some other models? I'll talk first of all, secular models. So this concept of the biopsychosocial is a step in the right direction, sort of treating all these different aspects. A social model specifically it talks about mental illness being defined by cultural conceptions of normality and that it can be somewhat arbitrary. It's shaped by our language and that there's an emphasis on rationality and that we exclude minorities. So this is something that we actually learn from a lot of the disability literature in saying that, disability is not necessarily a problem. It's only a problem because society views it as made it a problem. So this idea that mental illness can be more sort of socially constructed. And we talked about differences in different cultures. I like Brian Brock, who has done work on disability, and he says disability is not a medical condition, but a label attached to medically describable biophysiological conditions. In terms of another model, sort of the behavioral or the stress model, Thomas Sasse was one of the originators of this, and he says that a lot of these illnesses are really metaphors for problem behavior. And we've got rulemaking, so people play these games and adopt a posture of like helplessness, for example, deceit. And he says that basically what we've called mental illnesses are really just problems of living. And Carl Menninger, the Christian psychologist, he talked about it as a state of functioning or a way of behaving and not an illness. And finally, and this is fairly new, the idea of trauma and even micro-trauma. So it's not like the kids who are severely abused, but it's kids who maybe have some bullying at school. And it's relatively minor, but it can have huge effects on people. And there's a lot of recognition now in the secular psychotherapy of the effects of this. And this is the idea of looking at the root as opposed to looking at how it manifests in terms of symptoms. ACE study, I was going to say well known, but it's perhaps not as well known as it should be. Who's heard of the ACE study? Couple of people. Adverse childhood experiences study. And so looking at they've got a questionnaire and then just the huge outcomes, not only on mental health, but on physical health as well. So this link between childhood developmental trauma and mental illness. And as we've learned in those who were in this morning session, this two-way relationship between the brain and mind and the idea of neuroplasticity, things can change. There was Bessel van der Kolk has done a lot of work on this, and he advocated the term developmental trauma to go into the DSM, and it was rejected. Although I secretly diagnose almost all my patients with that just to be objectionable. Anyway, a few other models you could consider is a grief model. See all problems as being sort of a result of loss and not necessarily somebody dying, but, you know, a loss of a dream, etc. An addiction model can also be helpful. Anxiety can be seen as an addiction where I have to be busy the whole time. I have to be thinking, I can't stop, etc. The idea of meaning making, Viktor Frankl is known for that. Creative coping is looking at a positive way of looking at things, and running out of time here. So let's turn to a Christian view and how we can understand mental issues, psychological problems from a theological view of the human person. You're all familiar with us being created in God's image. Different views of this. So we're created as whole persons, but we are with limitations. We're rational, emotional, and volitional people. Historically, at least in Christian theology, emotions have been neglected, but there is a recovery of it. It's very holistic views that the Bible's fascinating. There's this conceptual overlap between the terms for heart, mind, and even kidneys, and body and soul. There's complex views of how they interact. Different perspective, a structural view talks about how we're made. A relational view considers how we are in relationship with God, with other people. And then a functional looks at what we do and how we fulfill the creation mandate, for example. So we're all, and it's best to incorporate all these different aspects of the image of God. We in the creation matter, we're given a social moral responsibility, including caring for ourselves and caring for others. We're called to be stewards of God's world. We have value and dignity, but it is limited with only an image. We can be affected and limited by our genetic predispositions, for example, other people's, our social structures. We can be limited at a more emotional level by our need for control, our fears, our pride. We hate uncertainty and ambiguity. We hate being wrong. All those things limit us. So we're finite beings. There's tension between our creaturely limitations and our ability to reflect beyond and recognize there's a transcendent reality. There is a God and it's not me. We don't like that. And this anxiety can be a precondition for sin. But we're also given freedom to choose. We're given freedom to turn away from the source of life and health or lead towards it. This, when we turn away, it can lead to distortions in our minds, our thinking, our emotions, and it can disrupt our relationships with ourselves and with others. And you can see this perspective is what results in what we now call psychological problems. So we could see the problem as being our failure to be fully human, our failure to image God appropriately and exercise our godly stewardship. Very briefly, of course, our image is restored through Christ. So looking at other models looking at disability, theology of suffering, etc. Different ways we could, you know, briefly see that maybe God's teaching us a lesson. I don't think that's fully explanatory. You know, this idea of soul making, growing our evil spirits. I think these are all minor things we could consider. The two major areas, again, from disability studies is the idea of creational diversity. So psychological promise, not necessarily an illness, but part of the diversity in God's good creation that we need to be accepting. Variations, people can be viewed as being uniquely gifted as opposed to ill. We don't have to be a person. We don't have to be perfect according to some societal norms. So I think this is definitely applicable to some conditions, but not necessarily all. And again, I think it's important to distinguish, not lump them all together. Some creational diversity, for example, I mentioned ADD, ASD. Some people would even say things like Down syndrome. But we might want to think about if somebody's born with something versus it's being acquired. And I read an interesting book saying that even schizophrenia can be a variation of human expression rather than a pathology. I'll maybe just sort of skip through this idea of sin. But basically it's complex. It's not just bad behavior. It's often our response to being sinned against. Like if we're hurt, this idea of hurt people, it can also be this idea of sort of low self-esteem, not considering ourselves worthy can be considered sinful. In that we're failing to fulfill the creation mandate, as I mentioned. We have irrational thinking, it's part of the structural model of things. We're focused on ourselves. We have problems in our relationships, and that's main reason people come for therapy. So how do we respond to sin? We can see it as, again, not just bad behavior, but an avoidance of anxiety. And that's where if you give people medication, say you have a mental illness, then they're avoiding actually growing and dealing with their anxiety, their uncertainty, etc. The good news is that we can be transformed into God's image. And this is where we can talk about healing, Christian transformation. So there's just a couple of definitions, and there's a quote from Irenaeus. So being human is to be fully alive and beholding God. So that's what our aim can be. And I'll leave this up because we're pretty much out of time. My apologies. When we think about psychotherapy, we can think about like two major things: uncovering obstacles to a healthy relationship with God, and then drawing people closer to God. So now, when we sort of sum up, this approach, we need to recognize humans are complex. We need to restore this. And a lot of psychological problems are really from a distorted image of God. Be cautious about uncritically accepting medical conditions, recognizing that there's multiple other factors, multifactorial etiology, we're not just biological creatures, we're not just a pack of neurons, recognition of microtraumas, using multiple models, navigating that difficult line between medical and spiritual, relying on the indwelling spirit to guide us in all truth. Self-awareness, we talked about briefly this morning. Embracing ambiguity, I mentioned, is really important. Now, I'll preempt some questions because I realize this is, there's still unanswered questions. So on an insurance form, you can't put somebody's diagnosis as, failing to adequately image God. So I'd like to try, but I realize that, like I said, we have to sort of navigate this fine line between the medical and spiritual. And I will leave it at that. But then we have the good news of the Holy Spirit who can guide us into all truth.
Good news. We have the time for questions. Between means I'm going to abuse my power and authority to ask that first question. So when Jesus, people were being brought to him, they mentioned four categories of people that are brought to him. So the sick, those with disabilities, those with seizures, and the demon-possessed. How would you intersect your work with that?
Okay, so first of all, like from the biblical, those were not necessarily four distinct categories. There was often a lot of overlap. Secondly, Jesus didn't heal just for the sake of healing. He did have compassion on people. He did want to heal. But a primary purpose of the healing acts were more theological, to show that he was the promised Messiah who would come to, so that the deaf would hear, the lame would walk, the blind would see. So it was primarily about, you know, showing the people that the kingdom of God had arrived. So I would say, and then my other comment would be, we cannot take contemporary scientific views and put them, you know, into the Bible. We have to look at it on its own terms and its own purposes, which would be very different than what we're talking about now.
Yeah, this question is maybe really out there. I don't know. You talked a bit about sort of not fully being true to God. And I think about Jesus's suffering prior to crucifixion, the anxiety that he felt in the garden to the point of sweat and blood, which seems pathological. So how do you relate that to this notion of not fully
actually, that's a great example. And it's... And that's exactly, I think you're still being influenced by our contemporary worldview and saying it's pathological. And I would say that's a great example of it being normal and emotions being normal. It's us who've decided we don't like being anxious. And so I'd say that's a good example of how Jesus exemplified the normality of struggles and suffering and emotions and anxiety, etc. Which is not to say that all suffering and all psychological struggles should be, God wants you to just go through this. Not at all. We still need to work to alleviate the suffering, but we don't want to always alleviate it too quickly. Right? Depending on what it is. Has to be a very individualized approach is what I think. No one size fits all kind of thing.
So I want to make sure I'm scanning the whole room here. So, far back corner.
Yeah, so like kind of building off of this a little bit, but in the history of Christianity, the Christian model of mental illness or illness in general is that is due to sin and or demon, which has been kind of problematic, a little bit ableist, but now we're coming into a more modern age. We have an idea that like the demons were probably more like seizures or something like that. So I guess my question is like, how do we transition from the idea of demons, which is what we've believed for like the last 15 to 1800 years, to now, and we're like, all right, well, it's like more complex.
Well, I actually did my PhD dissertation on demonology based on counseling a demonized client. So I don't think it's something that we should completely dismiss. The problem is that it was an all or nothing. It's like all mental illness was because of demons, right? So I think that's where we make the problems, or it was all due to sin. So I don't think we could completely discount demons and sin. We just should never, ever say that that's the only reason.
I mentioned it
as one of the, when we talk about the multifactorial etiology, I think as Christians, that is something that we could consider, but again, not an independent thing, because I would see the evil spirits as parasitic on wounding and on unresolved sin, etc. That they then, yeah, parasitic sin.
All right, we've got two more questions, so this might be kind of an overused question, but with an application. In what ways, with your expertise and your familiarity, how can we start to, how can we do our part to destigmatize mental illness and not necessarily focus on what we can do to help the situation, but the specific mental illness, but to simply destigmatize mental illness in general so we can focus on a person and not what's
what's wrong with them, tying back into the positive psychology. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I said earlier that the human flourishing approach is tying into the positive psychology, so not looking at the illness. So I think a big thing is, and it's a bit difficult because I know the church worked hard to get to accepting sort of the medical, and now I'm saying, okay, maybe we've gone too far. Now we sort of have to undo some of that stuff a bit. So one of the ways to destigmatize is be careful about the language you use. So we don't have to use the language of illness. We don't have to use the language of medication, etc. So we could use the language of struggle. We could use the language of spiritual growth. We could use the language of, and of course, I mean, also not only the language, but of course the social supports, the relationship healing that the church should be providing.
Last question.
So the first question I mentioned is healing and sadness. Like the healings, I think in a way the somewhat internal and biological, but the external in a way too, because you have these people being healed of leprosy and they're outcasts and they're being restored to their former social status in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if do you think there's implications to that for when you talk about the social model, disability?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, yeah. And again, when I said Jesus' primary purpose in the healings was not to just heal, right? So invariably the healings were also about, overcoming some of the Jewish restriction laws, like the leprosy, they were considered unclean, excluded from society, etc. So it made them clean. Healing is very much associated, even in linguistically, with salvation and deliverance. They're all actually quite intertwined in the Gospels. Understanding that. So again, be careful about seeing as, Jesus is the physician and healed, and that was it. We've got to look at it in the broader context of the healing, salvation, deliverance, advancing the kingdom of God, etc. So, yeah, the key thing with them, and by the way, the term used for leprosy actually is more like a skin disease, something like psoriasis. So it was not like this severely contagious thing, but they thought it was because people were white and looked death-like, and death, of course, is unclean, so they were excluded, etc. So, yes, it was about the restoration to community, which is part of the relational model of the image. So that's a big way that the church can be helping too.
All right, thank you.